This is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday, November 3rd. Feeling pretty good, yeah, with that extra hour of sleep. Anyway, we've got 44 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. Mostly sunny skies. Heber City is reporting 41 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. We're looking at a mix of clouds and sunshine. More clouds this morning, more sunshine developing for your Monday afternoon. Temperatures fairly nice out there with highs climbing into the mid-60s in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the upper 60s to near 70 in the Heber Valley. As we go into tonight, look for mostly clear skies. We'll see our overnight lows dipping down to around freezing in the Heber Valley with overnight lows in the mid-30s for St. Park City. Lots of sunshine is expected as we go into your Tuesday for Park City with highs in the low 60s. We'll be in the mid-60s for highs for you in the Heber Valley on your Tuesday with mostly sunny skies. Moving into your Wednesday, look for partly cloudy skies. As clouds increase, the winds will increase as well out of the south and west. High temperatures will be in the low 60s for us in Park City. Highs will be into the upper 60s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Wednesday night, we're going to be looking at partly cloudy skies. Could see an isolated shower to Wednesday night. A slightly better chance of a few isolated showers as we go into your Thursday with mostly cloudy skies. We'll see those high temperatures only in the upper 40s as cooler air rolls into Park City. High temperatures will be in the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Friday, we're looking at those partly cloudy skies, and we're looking at temperatures dipping down to around freezing. And then as we go into the afternoon hours here on your Friday, look for highs only around 50 in Park City, with highs in the mid to upper 50s in the Heber Valley. By the time we get towards your weekend, look for partly cloudy skies. It stays a little unsettled with a very slight chance of an isolated shower, but most of the weekend will be dry. We'll just have a mixture of clouds and sunshine. Temperatures for highs will be into the low 50s on your Saturday in Park City. Highs will be into the upper 50s in the Heber Valley. As we get towards your Sunday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies with temperatures in the upper 50s to near 60 in Park City, with highs in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Scheduled to talk with Summit County Clerk Efers and Wasatch County Clerk Joey Granger with the latest on tomorrow's election. Then Heber City Manager Matt Brower calling in to give us an update on some of the issues happening in and around Heber City, and the Director of Business and Operations for the Adopt of Native Elder Rug Show and Sale, C.J. Robb, joining us after a stop to this rug show since 2019. Well, 2 days after delaying a decision on new boundaries, the Wasatch County School District Board of Education got out its pencils to redraw the lines. KPCW's Christine Weller reports board priorities were split, but a date is now set for a vote.
The Wasatch County School District Board of Education is under a time crunch to establish the boundaries. Deer Creek High School is set to open in fall 2026, and for it to have high school sports, the Utah High Schools Association must know how many students will attend by mid-December. The board was set to approve a boundary dividing students between Deer Creek and Wasatch High Tuesday. But after around 80 community members packed the meeting room to share their concerns, the board opted to delay a final boundary decision. The board went back to the drawing board Thursday morning during a special session, interrupting their daily lives to make the timing work. Board President Kim Dickerson delayed a trip. Vice President Corey Holmes and members Brad Ellert and Jake Collette went to work late, while Breanne Diedrichson handed off childcare duties to her husband. They discussed the public's biggest complaint. The proposed boundary split Daniels Canyon and J.R. Smith Elementary students between the middle schools. Diedrichson lives and represents community members in the Wheeler Park area who didn't want the elementaries split. She was steadfast about using boundary option B, which kept the schools together.
That is hard on middle schoolers to be the only two out of your close friend group to have to go by yourself to a whole new population. I've heard people say, keep them together, either school.
However, Dickerson, Collette, and Holmes were in favor of option H. Similar to the board's preferred boundary, option D, it would use Highway 40 as a natural boundary. Students who live east of Highway 40 would attend Timpanogos Middle School and Wasatch High. Students to the west would go to Rocky Mountain Middle School and Deer Creek High. But instead of heading east at Heritage Farms Parkway, the boundary would be bumped up to the Cove neighborhood near J.R. Smith. Dickerson said this would satisfy many families in the area as their kids would attend the same middle school. The option also balances the number of students at the middle and high schools. She said sawmill area families would also be satisfied.
They were quiet before, when the boundary proposal went out publicly, and they've been quiet after our meeting. So to me, that speaks volumes of, you know, what they're not saying is what they're saying.
Holmes said option H, with slight alterations, would also correct a, quote, bad boundary in the Cove area, which was split about 9 years ago. Eller and Diedrichsen worried option H could create another bad boundary. Diedrichsen said Wheeler Park would be split similar to how the Cove area is. On the other hand, Holmes said the Wheeler Park neighborhoods aren't connected by road, so it's okay to put those students in different schools. Collette agreed, saying option H disrupts the least amount of people while prioritizing natural boundaries and evenly distributed school attendance.
When roads connect, that's how you link neighborhoods. Right now, there isn't a way for those new homes to connect to the neighborhood south of them.
Another benefit of option H is it's similar enough to option D that a 30-day notice isn't required before approval. With the majority of its members on the same page, the board set a date to approve new boundaries, Wednesday, November 5th at 6:30 p.m. The meeting will be open to community members. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Live PC, Give PC, Park City's annual day of giving for community nonprofits, will be held this Friday, November 7th. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports that fundraising has already begun.
Nearly 200 nonprofits from all over Park City and Summit County are participating in the 15th annual Live PC, Give PC. Christine Coleman of the Park City Community Foundation says the annual fundraiser is meant to help ensure everyone in the Wasatch Back can thrive.
The nonprofits really, really ensure that our community is vibrant and thriving. It helps the locals, the workforce, kids, seniors, definitely newcomers, part-timers, visitors all benefit from the many programs that nonprofits provide to us.
Organizations participating in Live PC, Give PC represent a wide spectrum of causes. On the fundraising dashboard, donors can search based on interests like education or recreation.
For example, if you're concerned about affordable housing here in our area, you can search on housing and all the organizations that focus on housing will come up. If you love horses, search on horses.
Giving is open now through next Friday, November 7th. At midnight, the Community Foundation reveals the fundraising total. Last year, nonprofits raised over $5 million. Coleman says people shouldn't shy away from giving just a few dollars. Matching gifts and power hours help those smaller gifts go farther. Vail Resort's Epic Promise Foundation is supporting this year's power hours.
Especially at this moment in time where there are many programs that are being hard hit by the loss of federal funds and dealing with financial uncertainty. So this is a very important time to support the nonprofits that provide so many services for us.
The foundation is aiming for 7,150 individual donors and at least 5.15 million in donations. As in years past, there will be community celebrations around town. From 4 to 6 p.m., the Park City Library will have live music, free refreshments, and games for all ages to enjoy. For those over 21, the party continues at High West Saloon and the O'Shucks White House from 8 p.m. until midnight. The Park City Community Foundation is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, tomorrow is Election Day, and on the phone to tell us what you need to know, I have the clerk from Summit County, Eve First, joins me on the line. Good morning, Eve. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, let's talk just a little bit about, we've had, of course, early voting and mail-in voting. How many ballots have you received so far? What's the turnout like?
We have received over 4,000 ballots, and we are at about a 32% turnout, which is great for this point in a municipal election. That's a really great turnout.
So if somebody still has their ballot, what do they need to do with it?
Well, so if they have their ballot, want to use it today and tomorrow, the thing to do is to go to one of our drop boxes. And we have a bunch of them throughout the county. In Park City, we have one at the Park City Library. And we have one out at the Quinn's Health Building, County Health Building. And then we also have one at the market that's inside. The one at the library and at Quinn's are open 24 hours. And the one at the market is open during the hours the market is open. And then outside of Park City, we have one at Kimball Junction at The DMV at Richmond's building is open 24/7. The one in Camas at the Camas County building is open 24/7. And the one at the Summit County Library in Colville is open 24/7, as are the drop boxes at the Hennepin Town Hall and the Francis Town Hall. And then the one in the Summit County Courthouse and the one at in the Oakley City Hall, those are open when the building is open.
Okay. Let's see. If somebody did not get a ballot, what do they need to do?
So the best thing to do at this point is come and vote in person tomorrow. Tuesday, Election Day, we'll be starting voting at 7 a.m. and it will go until 8 p.m. tomorrow night. And we have three locations for this election. We'll have, it's going to be a little different in Park City. We're going to have it out at the Quinn's Health Department, out at the Junction, in the lower conference room. That is in the Round Valley area. It's on Round Valley Drive. And then we'll also have Colville City Hall will be open, and the Camas Library also will be open for in-person voting. And if you haven't gotten your ballot, that's the way to go at this point. Just make sure you bring your ID, your picture ID.
Okay, is that all they need? Do they need a birth certificate, Social Security number, anything like that?
If their driver's license is up to date and they are a registered voter in Summit County, that's all they need. And they can check that online at vote.utah.gov, whether they're registered. If they know they're not registered or they have moved and they need to change their registration, they need to bring both proof of where they live and proof of who they are. A valid picture ID plus something that shows where your current address is. That could be a lease, it could be a utility bill. Banks require you to have your physical address, and so something from the bank showing what your physical address, those are all options.
Okay. Let's see. It is too late to mail a ballot. I guess when would have been a safe date to have put that in the post office box?
I hate to estimate that because so much can depend on, you know, how pickup works and where you're mailing it from. I will say our receipts, the ballots we're receiving through the mail are starting to diminish. And so that suggests to me our voters have been getting the message and understand to mail it earlier in the process if they're going to need to use that option, say they're out of state.
All right. So in terms of the drop boxes, though, people can drop them off at those locations that you mentioned until 8 p.m. So what do you have, staff and just staffed at each of those drop boxes, and then they just collect them right at 8?
So the way we do it, we have somebody at each of the drop boxes to lock the box at 8 o'clock or to make sure it is no longer available for putting ballots into it. And then if, for instance, our 24-hour drop boxes, they're all secured in place. They have a locking mechanism. And we have one person out there locking the drop box and letting people know it's too late to drop off your ballot if they happen to come after 8 o'clock. And then we pick those up the next day. They're secured, and because of staffing, we need two people to pick up ballots from a drop box, and that's just a lot of people at that time of night after a very long day to do that. So for most of the ballots, most of the drop boxes we'll pick up at the next morning. But we will have picked up ballots at midday tomorrow, so and we're hopefully have those all counted by tomorrow night. But that's sort of that last chunk of data that you get on Wednesday is from those drop boxes.
All right. You also offered early voting. Did you get people to turn out for that?
We do. It's always a pretty small number, but we did have early voting turnout, and often it's people who did not get a ballot in the mail and are worried either won't be available on election day or it's hard for them, and so that's when they vote. A lot of the people who prefer to vote in person for the tradition of it, they like to wait until election day.
All right. So when do you expect to have the votes counted tomorrow night?
So tomorrow night, we certainly expect to have results out probably around 8:30. Polls will close at 8. We will get that round out as quickly as we can so that people get that information. There is a site that we post on through the state. Once that becomes live, then we can post on our website and provide it to all the municipalities.
All right. Now, with all of the ballots having to be in by 8 p.m. tomorrow night, it seems like we should have a really good count tomorrow night as well. We won't have to wait for days for those ballots in the mail to show up, I guess.
Right. There's one type of ballot. We still wait the 14 days for the canvas, which is what makes the election official. There will be a reduced likelihood of significant numbers changing after Wednesday. So as I said, there are actually a lot of people that drop mail on Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening. We'll also have the in-person votes on Tuesday. That'll all get counted for Wednesday. And then after that, it should be a lower number and probably won't change too much after that.
All right. So what do you do with the ballots that show up in the mail later in the week?
So if we get a ballot we can't count because it comes in later that week, and there are certain types of ballots our uniformed and overseas voters are still allowed to mail them in, and they are postmark related. That's federal law. So those can come in and still get counted. That's a very small number. So the other ones that come in after that point, we send them a letter letting them know that their ballot was not counted because it was received too late.
Okay, so at least they do know. That's good.
Yeah.
So already at 32% with turnout, what kind of voter turnout are you expecting?
Well, I have to say that's higher than we've had the last couple municipals already. So I'm kind of hoping maybe we get to a 45% here, which would be akin to what we see sometimes in primaries, which tend to be more focused. But yeah, that's what I'm guessing at this point. But it's a great turnout.
All right. New legislation, thanks to House Bill 300, have created some changes taking place next year along in 2028. Can you kind of identify some of those changes that people should look forward to?
Sure. So we have already as a county started the shift by including asking people to put their last four digits of their social security number or their driver's license number onto the ballot. And then that allows us to verify their identity that way. They still have to sign the ballot because you're signing an affidavit that says you have a right to vote and that you're only voting this one ballot and that you have a right to vote in this particular location. And so they still have to sign it, but we can check their social. And we've had that. People have been really good about putting that on their ballot so far. But if you didn't have an election this year, that'll certainly be something new to you next year. People have been good about that, and it is actually the verification is a lot more straightforward on that because it is numbers as opposed to trying to tell if someone's signature on their driver's license from 4 years ago is the same as the way they signed their ballot. So that's one change. We also have a change as far as people are going to start. We've included on the ballot this year an opt-in box to get your ballot to continue to be sent to you by mail. That is something people are going to need to do every 8 years, starting in 2029. If you opt in now by checking that box on your ballot, or when you register to vote, or when you're at the DMV and you check the box to register to vote there, you can also check the box to receive your ballot by mail. All of that, if you do it leading up to 2029, it will be good for 8 years after 2029. So it it doesn't hurt to do that early and get that squared away. So those are, and then of course the drop off deadline as far as having to have the ballot in our hands, regardless of postmark, by 8 o'clock on election day. Those are the big changes from last year.
Okay, so I understand how the clerk's office would have somebody's driver's license number, but how did you get Social Security numbers to verify?
So we don't get the whole number. We have the last four of the social, and how we have that is through the state has a database. The state voter registration database checks people's socials. They can check it with the Social Security Administration, the last four. And that is through having the person's, by having the person's information, like their name and their birth date. And so that's how we're checking that. And so like when you sign up to vote, you give us your birth date and that's how that populates in our database.
Okay. And are you on board with this? I mean, is there, it sounds like there was some need to move away from signature verification. So the license and Social Security number is not as easy to commit fraud?
Well, so I think there are a couple different issues at play here. I think we saw last year a lot of concern about verification of signatures. And is that a subjective measure? How can we make it so that it is objective, a signature is either objectively verifiable or not, while at the same time making sure we count votes? And there was a lot of debate at the legislature about the right way to do this and the whether to do it at all, because there was a big push to get rid of mail-in voting last year completely. And so the decision in the end from the legislature was to put the four digits on, still have the signature. If the four digits don't match, then you go to the signature. I think you're still going to see a lot of debate about that this year again at the legislature, because there are different feelings about that. And as far as what objectively verifiable versus, you know, what might be harder to copy. One of the things we know is, you know, family members often will have your Social Security number or the last four of your social. We would hope and think that most family members would not try to take your ballot and vote it on your behalf. And so that's, I think, where the legislature was coming from of, you know, those are numbers people tend to be more careful with and protect, and they recognize the value of that, and yet also they can verify that it's them. So I think that's where they're coming from. The signature certainly is harder to copy, but we also end up, like, for instance, with a lot of young people and a lot of older people, we end up not counting their ballots, sending them signature verification cards, asking them to verify whether they did in fact vote, because their signatures do change a lot in those years. So for instance, somebody can pre-register to vote at 16, and then they might not vote again until they're 20. And over that time, a signature can change a lot. Likewise, if you have some, as people get older, they can have trouble with arthritis or other issues where their signature can change, or even an injury. You know, if you have a broken hand, you're going to be writing with your other hand. And so there are things like that that make the signature a challenge. And so the four digits is quicker, which results in our getting results faster. And it is more objective, so we can go back and make sure it's done correctly without a doubt. And so those are some good things, but there is the downside of, there are more people who might know it.
Okay. After this, if voters have any other questions about how to vote, what's the best place, where's the best place to go?
So the best place to go is vote.utah.gov. You'll put in your address and it will tell you whether you have a ballot or not. There are lots of voters in Summit County who do not have a ballot for this election. Because they are in the unincorporated county. There are a few that do, but most people do not, and that's probably why you don't have a ballot. If you have questions, check there, or you're always welcome to check our office, to call our office, and we can check that for you if you're having trouble.
Okay. Anything else, Eve, you wanted to mention?
I do just want to highlight again, voting in person this year for Park City folks will be out at Quinn's Junction at the County Health Building, because that is a change.
Okay. Eve Furr, Summit County Clerk, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, due to tomorrow's election, there will be no Heber City Council meeting on Tuesday, but on the phone with a look at what's happening in Heber City, I have City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, we were just talking with Summit County Clerk Eve Furr, and unfortunately Wasatch County Clerk Joey Granger was unable to join us as scheduled. But anything you want to mention about tomorrow's election?
Get out and vote. This is the public's opportunity to exercise their rights as a citizen, and I encourage everyone to go vote.
Okay. Well, November has begun, and no federal food aid has been distributed. Any idea how many people in Heber City rely on SNAP or other federal programs like that?
I don't know what that number might be. I can tell you that several of our charity organizations, like the Christian Center of Park City, which has a branch in Heber, have come forward and asked the community for certain foodstuffs, which they are in short supply. And if your listeners are interested in helping, I'd invite them to go to the website for the CCPC and contribute where they can.
Okay. Any other resources available that you know of besides the Christian Center?
Other places they can donate is the Wasatch County Community Alliance, which is one that's also trying to help where they can. So mm-hmm. A lot of places, those are probably the two I'd recommend your listeners go to.
Okay. Jordan L. Ridge, there's been some debate whether Heber City is choosing the right path to protect open space in Jordan L. Ridge. What's the latest in those conversations?
We are still waiting to meet, meetings to be set with the landowner, Wasatch County and Heber City, for the purpose of reviewing the agreement the city has taken 4 years to negotiate to see if there's any changes that Wasatch County would like to incorporate. So looking to the meeting, which should be set, and having a conversation about additional changes that are desired.
Yeah, Heber City Mayor Heidi Franco has publicly disagreed with the city council's approach to this easement. Do you share her concerns?
Well, this is a policy decision, plain and simple. There's two paths that the council can go down. The first, of course, is to use a third-party conservation organization like Summit Lands. And the second is to own the easement ourselves. And so this is simply a policy debate that the council has decided one way and the mayor decided a second way.
Yeah. So why did the city opt for this approach instead of working with a land trust?
There's a number of reasons. First, the landowner would not receive the traditional IRS benefits that someone would get with donating their land into a conservation easement. When you donate your land, you typically get an IRS benefit because you're donating it at a significant discount. In this case, they would not be doing that. Secondly, they're not receiving any monies like from the Wasatch Open Lands Board. And so the typical benefits for doing it don't exist here. And in the negotiations with the county that have been taking place for the last 4 years, there was no interest on the part of the county and no interest on the part of the developer, at least to date, for doing that.
So how do the city and county plan to move forward? I mean, what are the next steps to finalize this easement?
It goes to the meeting, which is to be held sometime in the first couple of weeks in November, where we'll sit down and listen to the ideas that they have. We've been negotiating now for several years, so a few more weeks ain't going to mean a lot, but we'll continue to have a conversation and see if we can't land this in a place that everyone's comfortable.
Okay. Let's see. The city also considering a contract with CAMS, the Community Alliance for Main Street, to add more events and activities in the Main Street Park. What would CAMS be responsible for doing? What kind of events do you have in mind here?
So CAMS, if we negotiate an agreement and get it adopted, would take point on a lot of the events to take place at our Main Street Plaza or our Main Street Park. So they would take point in the planning, the implementation, and the execution of those events. They would take point on perhaps programming events in other parts of the downtown. They would assist the city on some of the larger events that we currently do, such as the Halloween Fest, the old-fashioned Christmas. And so CAMS, representing the local businesses, would assist the city in putting on these events to the quality that we're expecting in the future.
All right. Right now you're asking CAMS to contribute about 50 days of programming per year. How does that fit into the bigger goal of some 250 days of park activities every year?
Well, every journey begins with the first step, and so this is the first step to achieve the 50 days. And so I'm confident that we'll achieve that in calendar year 26 and look to maybe increase those numbers in the future. The city also recently entered into an agreement, or will enter into an agreement, with a company called Terracon to look at additional investments in the park. This would be considered Phase B investments, which may include an ice ribbon. And if we are successful at building an ice ribbon, of course, that would be open many nights in the winter, and that would add significantly to that count or that number.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the council has chosen a design firm for the park redevelopment plans. What's happening next in that process?
That's the company Terracon. We're negotiating an agreement and hope to have that done within the next few weeks. And then we'll commence as part of their phase one work, connecting with the community to receive more public input on the initial plans that were developed by a consultant by the name of Roger Brooks. So, this second phase is going to be kicking off here probably late November, early December.
Okay. And then moving on to water conservation, at the Planning Commission meeting last week, leaders talked about adding a water conservation plan to the city's general plan. How come?
State statute was amended, I think, last year, requiring cities to include water conservation as a chapter or an element in their general plan. So this initiative is simply to comply with state statute.
Okay, and what is included in that plan?
I'm not entirely sure what the content is, other than the state has a keen interest in making sure that what water is available is used as efficiently as possible. As you know, we live in the second driest state in the union, and it's critical that we use our resources, limited resources, to the best that we possibly can.
Yeah, and how will this change how Heber uses water, if at all?
Heber City has actually been fairly proactive in trying to conserve water. For example, we are in the process of wrapping up a multi-year capital project where we are establishing meters in all of our pressurized irrigation customer accounts. This should help us save significant irrigation water. We've also been very active in the past putting computers to our irrigation systems so we can control them remotely and only water when it's actually necessary. And so I think we've been fairly cutting edge based upon our capital investments and our current operating practices.
All right. Now, you are required to have this plan in place by the end of the year. What are the next steps here?
I believe the next steps would be public hearing. I don't know if they've had the public hearing yet, so that would be the next step, is to get public input on it, and then, of course, onto the City Council for adoption and inclusion in the general plan.
Yeah. And how do water requirements play a role when the city's considering new development agreements? I mean, do we know that Heber has enough water for all of the development that's planned?
Heber City cannot approve development unless the project, the developer, can substantiate they have sufficient water rights or shares sufficient to meet their development's needs. So we do not adopt or we do not approve developments unless they can validate that they have necessary water rights. And so that's part of our process that we use to validate the needs and make sure that they're in place before we give approvals.
Okay. Anything else, Matt, that you wanted to mention?
Just to reiterate, voting tomorrow, get out and vote and make your voice get heard.
Okay. Appreciate your time, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Adoptive Native Navajo Rug Show and Sale is back. In the studio with details, I have the Director of Business and Operations for Adoptive Native Elder, CJ Robb. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. So is this the first rug show since 2019, huh?
It is. It's the first in-person show. We pivoted and had virtual shows for 2020 through 2024, and we're really excited to have the opportunity to be back in person. I think for all of our weavers, you know, Adopt a Native Elder's mission through 40 years of service on the reservation has been to bring together different cultures and service to the elders and help heal that divide between cultures caused by generations of abuse and subjugation and genocide. And to be able to bring the elders back to Park City and have people interact with them directly is so special. It's so important to experience that culture.
Yeah, so why did it take so long? Because certainly we've, you know, been pretty good with, you know, things after 2021.
Absolutely. Some of it is the planning. You know, the being able to go virtual was a big pivot, and being able to invite so many people from around the world to join and support the elders through a virtual format was really special, especially during the pandemic. And then it takes a lot longer with, you know, the Native people were really hit hard with COVID. We lost over 180 elders in the program between 2020 and 2021. And when we went down on the food runs after the pandemic, right after, you know, we started going back down in the fall of 2021, and every single family that you talk to lost somebody. It'd be, you know, we lost our mom, we lost our sister, we lost a nephew. And so it's not a quick process in getting them back up to being willing to travel, come to the show. And so this is really a special opportunity, and it'll be a little bit different than in the past because not doing an in-person show for 5 years, some of those traditional elders that people saw for the first 30 years of the show have passed on or aren't able to travel anymore. So it'll be a new group of weavers and a new group of volunteers, which is really exciting.
So this year's event carries the theme, We Come From the Stars. What inspired this? And I guess, what does it signify for the weavers and the community in general?
Yeah, so this is really special. It started in the spring. We were kind of talking about a theme, and our founder and executive director, Linda Myers, was saying that, you know, she was really distressed by the lack of unity and strife and division in the world, and she wanted to do something that would help to heal that and bring it back together. And in the Navajo culture, it's a very traditional belief that everybody is made out of stardust, that and the stars are such a special cultural piece of their belief system. They do certain ceremonies when certain stars are in the sky. There's a, you know, they make special offerings to the stars. And so to have the weavers do these rugs that are unique to the show, they've never done this type of star before, but they each have a different meaning, whether it's a star that's for healing, a star that's for guidance, and hopefully they bring a little bit of peace and harmony back to the rug show and to our community as well.
All right. So when and where is the sale happening?
So it starts this Friday, November 7th. It runs through the weekend, the 8th and the 9th. And we're hoping to get a lot of people out. It's a common misconception that the rug show is a fundraiser. It's not a fundraiser. It's a marketplace where these weavers set all of their own prices. They receive 100% of the proceeds from their sales. And every sale helps them sustain their lifestyle in their traditional way. It has an immediate need. Every rug sold is helping to feed a family through the winter, is helping to purchase firewood so that they have the gift of warmth through the cold winter months, is helping to buy hay to feed their animals and keep that traditional lifestyle going. So they rely on these sales. They rely on people coming out to learn about the rugs and hopefully to find a piece of art that they fall in love with and take home.
All right. Well, with 100% of the sale proceeds going directly to the weaver, how do you cover your overhead and event costs?
So a lot of it comes through donations and sponsorships throughout the year. The presenting sponsor of the show is the George and Dolores Eccles Foundation, who have supported Adopt a Native Elder for a very long time. They do, we couldn't put the show on without them. Deer Valley also does a great job in providing the lodge and all of the facilities. They're housing all of the elders this year, and so their commitment to bringing the show back has made a massive difference.
Okay, as you mentioned, the dates are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Friday night, actually, is just 6 to 9. There is a $40 charge for that. The other 2 days are free.
What? Saturday and Sunday are free. If you want to get that first shot, see all of the rugs right as they go for sale. It's worth that $40 ticket price, and there's past hors d'oeuvres and everything, which is what that $40 covers. So you get some snacks in the lodge. There's also a silent auction, which does benefit Adopt a Native Elder. It starts to defray some of those costs of putting on the event. And then hopefully there's a little left over to help provide firewood and food certificates over the winter months. But over Saturday and Sunday, there's programming throughout the days. Saturday, there's a children's weaving demonstration, a weaving demonstration by the elders, and a children's powwow where there will be Native youth sharing dances and culture. And then on Sunday, there's a veteran ceremony that starts off the day. We invite all the veterans to come. The Native American people have one of the highest rates of service in the armed forces of any cultural group. And so a lot of these elders and weavers that come to the show have lost family members to armed conflict, and they do a beautiful ceremony blessing veterans, and so everybody's invited for that. And then they do a weaving demonstration in the afternoon, and the show closes with a powwow featuring dancers from all across the Native nations all across the country.
All right. Do people need to purchase a ticket to the Friday night gala first?
Friday night, you can purchase in advance through www.annelder.org, or the tickets are available at the door as well.
Okay, so no need to...
No need to purchase in advance, yep.
All right, anything new or different this year compared to previous shows, considering it is the first in-person show since 2019?
Some of that Saturday programming is really special, bringing in the youth to actually share. And a lot of that's done with Eileen Quintana. She's a board member with Adopt a Native Elder. She's the head of Indian Education for the Nebo School District. And she does an amazing job of doing cultural education with Native youth. And so bringing them in to be able to share that, you know, these younger generations are learning the art and culture and tradition and songs that go into weaving. They're learning the traditional dances and the purpose of all of those dances is really special. And I think, you know, we'll probably lose a lot of the elders from their tables where they were selling rugs, because they're going to want to go watch the kids share their weaving and dancing as well. So that's really special.
Yeah. So how are the weavers selected and brought in for the show? And what do you do with them during the 3 days?
Yeah. So the weavers, I mean, it grew. The program, really, the rug show started with one elder from Big Mountain. Her name was Katie Furcap. She's been at every rug show for 30 years. She won't be here this year, but her daughter will be. And she brought a rug to one of the first food runs and asked Linda to take it and sell it for her. And Linda sold it and brought back all of the proceeds from that rug and gave it to her. And the next time she came down on a food run, Katie had all of her sisters there, and they all had two rugs, and they asked her to sell it. And it really became clear that these weavers, when they were able to weave and they had the resources to have the traditional wool, have this traditional way of sustaining themselves and their families, but they didn't have a marketplace for it. And so that was the birth of the rug show, is creating a way for these weavers to sell. All of the weavers are either in Adopt a Native Elder program or a relative of an elder that's in the Adopt a Native Elder program. There's about 25 weavers that'll be in attendance at the show. There's more than 70 weavers that'll be represented that have consigned work or sent it in to be featured during the show. And a lot of weavers sell through Adopt a Native Elder because it's their best resource to earn income, where they set their prices, get all the proceeds. And it's a rare opportunity to sell at a show where their traditions and culture are honored, their beliefs are held sacred. You know, that's really unique to the rug show.
Yeah, and I was going to mention, I mean, weaving among the Navajo elders, both an art and cultural heritage. I mean, so how does this show help preserve that?
Really, giving the elders a marketplace to sell helps preserve it, because they have a reason to continue weaving. Adopt a Native Elder also distributes over $80,000 worth of wool to the weavers every year that helps them have the resources that they need to continue weaving. And one of the most special things about the elders having a marketplace and having the resources to weave is that it means, you know, a lot of these elders live in multi-generational homes. And when the elder is still weaving, they're sharing the teachings and the songs and the stories that go along with the weaving. They're sharing the cultural importance of the designs that go into the rug. And as that gets passed down to the generations, you're helping to preserve not just the culture and traditions, but that sense of identity of being a Navajo person as well.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, many of the elders, in addition to the multi-generational, they live in very remote and traditional conditions. I mean, we have heard of just the poverty. I mean, no running water. I mean, how have conditions improved, if at all?
There's an increase in the number of people who have access to electricity and running water. Many of the elders that we serve are still those traditional people that have never lived off the reservation. They live very remotely out in the desert, and they practice their traditional ceremony still. They speak their Navajo language still. They wear their traditional dress still. And we're seeing a shift now where the new elders that are coming into the program, you have to be over 75 to enter the Adopt a Native Elder program, but the next generation of elders that's starting to join the program are the boarding school era of elders. They have, a lot of them have been taken away from the reservation. They've been put through boarding school. Some were taken away and put through the placement program. And so they have a different background. They have a different level of Western education. Some of them don't dress as traditionally anymore. And as we see that shift, one of the things that's really unique is a lot of those people ended up moving back to the reservation. They went there, some of them to take care of their parents, some of them to serve in their communities. And as they've aged, they wind up in the same economic condition as their parents were. They are living in their parents' homes. They are living remotely without access to utilities. And they are, you know, living with very little monthly monetary support. And so they still need that. Adopt a Native Elder's main goal is the distribution of humanitarian goods. We support with food and firewood and medical supplies. So.
Yeah. Now, are any other Native American tribe assisted here, or are we just talking still Navajo?
Adopt a Native Elder just supports Navajo elders, and really we're not even meeting the need with just the Navajo elders. There's, you know, we have 860 elders in the program right now. We serve 14 different geographic locations on the reservation, but the Navajo reservation's huge. It's the size of the state of West Virginia or the country of Belgium. It's a massive area of land, and there's more than 200,000 people that live there. So meeting that need for all of the elders is still a work in progress.
Yeah, reservation where? Northern Arizona? Is it New Mexico?
Mainly Northern Arizona, corner of Northwestern New Mexico, and then a sliver of Southern Utah as well.
Okay. All right. Are there any ways that people can support the elders if they can't attend in person this weekend?
Absolutely. We are selling rugs and jewelry on behalf of the elders through our website all throughout the year. We're a volunteer-run organization. We need volunteers to come work in our warehouse and help pack food and supplies. We need volunteers to volunteer on food runs and help us go down and deliver on the reservation. And we're always looking for people to sponsor an elder or make a donation. One of our biggest needs at the moment is firewood. We distribute about $1 million worth of firewood vouchers a year to elders, just so that we don't lose elders through the winter months to freezing to death. Those basic resources to make sure that they have a way to heat their homes through the winter. So you can always donate, volunteer, and you can learn more at our website, annelder.org.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, CJ?
I think just thank you to the community for hosting this event. It makes a huge difference for these elders. It makes a huge difference for their families, not just in their ability to sustain themselves, but in the bringing together different cultures and knowing that there is we hear it often on food runs, an elder will stand up and they say, "We've never met white people like you." The abuse that these people have experienced is horrific. And so being a part of beginning to heal that makes a huge difference.
Okay. CJ Robb is the Director of Business and Operations for Adoptive Native Elder. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And again, the Adoptive Native Elder Navajo Rug Show and Sale happening again this weekend, November 7th through the 9th at Deer Valley's Snow Park Lodge.